All right, rabble rousing for today, the 3rd of December, 2008, shows where I'm at. I'll begin with a brief letter to the editor that was sent to Nexus Magazine, one of my favorite magazines out of Australia. Okay, this is a letter to the editor. He quotes a recent article in the magazine that was titled Arctic Seabed Afire with Lava Spewing Volcanoes. Very interesting indeed. Excuse me, but isn't the Arctic, well, you know, being reported as melting at a far greater rate due to global warming? Well, hello. What happens when you put ice in a pot and heat it? Since when does atmospheric pollution cause volcanic eruptions? Clearly, the answer to the Arctic ice melting is underwater heating. Hello? Global warming due to our screwing with CO2 emissions? Yeah, right. Where the hell is the truth? So that's one Australian's comment on global warming. The publishing date on this next article was November 1st, but I think the overall perspective remains the same. It's by James West. He's writing in www.midasletter.com. He calls it the War of Attrition. The spot price of gold, as quoted by NYMEX, is no longer an accurate representation of the real price at which physical gold bullion is being traded. It is, in fact, a lie. This is apparent by the great disparity between the availability of gold and the virtual shutting down of all sales operations relating to delivery of anything denominated in one-ounce units. Buffaloes, Krugerrands, Eagles, you name it, you can't buy them. The idea of futures was originally established as a mechanism for price discovery, not price determination. Yet this very mechanism, first deployed as a way for bankers to capitalize farmers in the spring with a relative degree of certainty as to what the farmer would reap in the fall, has become a tool for manipulation of the gold market. In creating such huge short positions in the futures market and driving the price down, the spot price suffers as a result of the physical short created to hedge against a paper long. It's an elementary simplification to state that a thing is worth what someone's willing to pay for it. The fact that bullion dealers are paying and charging premiums to the spot price for gold is clearly evidence that the spot price published each day is no longer an accurate representation of the price of gold, and its continuing publication as such must soon be identified as fraudulent and thus corrected. The likelihood of that happening, however, is counting upon the admission by various U.S. government entities that they have participated in the suppression of the gold price, and that is simply not likely to happen in this lifetime. Just as frontline military police and soldiers were court-martialed for the excesses of violence perpetrated on detainees from Iraq and Afghanistan, heads will likely roll in theatrical fashion to satisfy a media-moderated demand for blood. The danger here is that we have several new bubbles building, and the massive inflation of currencies worldwide now underway, while acting temporarily to stave off the inevitable explosive correction, is steadily adding pressure to the chamber in which this monetary ordinance is being compressed. When the price of gold does finally erupt, as the massive currency devaluation going on outside of the United States dollar causes panic selling, the damage will again be amplified exponentially because of disingenuous information distribution. Interestingly, the campaign to undermine the global perception of gold is achieving a certain success. Even hardcore gold bugs are capitulating and abandoning their heretofore staunchly defended argument that in essence said, when the crash comes, gold will take off, which at this point hasn't happened. So now even gold bugs, to some degree, are abandoning their posts. It is at this point in a war of attrition that men are separated from boys, those who fight with the courage of their convictions, from those who follow the albeit contrarian herd, and battles are historically won against great odds. In pursuing the development of a feature-length documentary film that seeks to expose the pattern of fraud and deceit that has emerged in the fiscal and monetary policy of the last 100 years, many, including some who have traditionally written in support of such a position, have suggested that this is a David and Goliath matchup of biblical proportions that has a faint hope of success. Obviously, all the gold bugs and GATA supporters and writers and analysts and traders and bloggers combined could not finance any sort of information campaign comparable to the mighty mainstream media diversion of the G7 perception management machine. But to capitulate at this point, to accede to defeat and abandon the barricades, as it were, is either short-sighted or revealing of an absence of deep conviction in the first place. This is the desired outcome of the global banking cartel's campaign. In a brilliant emulation of Orwellian logic, the availability of gold has been increased from, quote, as much as you'd care to buy, to, you can't buy any. And in the absence of such supply, the price is increased from 1,000 per ounce plus to under, the price is decreased from 1,000 per ounce plus to under 750. Tokyo Rose would be hysterical with glee at such a coup of propaganda. Whole legions of otherwise sensible people are accepting the logic as distributed from the ivory towers and hoarding U.S. dollars of all things, and abandoning the idea of gold as the historic store and measure of value. This is simply astounding. People think the United States government is rushing to their defense with all these bailouts and stimulus packages. They refuse to see what is clearly the repetition of a pattern perfected during financial crises of the last century. The cherry-picking of the top assets in banking, in tandem with the elimination of the competition for pennies on the dollar, should be enshrined in a national festival. It's so predictable. We could call it Fleece the Sheep Week, or something. Unfortunately, the period of asset reallocation and concentration lasts more than a week. Typically, it's a few years until the booty is divvied up and the system resaturated with cheap money for another round of global asset pinata bashing. You can hold on to your U.S. dollars if you want to, though it is unlikely that those who can see the truth behind what is unfolding in front of our very eyes will change their tune just because it is increasingly fashionable to do so. Gold will emerge as the asset class and currency of the patient and the visionary. That was James West in MidasLetter.com. My commentary for today, December 3rd. Rabble-rousing shows are now archived and can be heard at your convenience 24/7. Tell your friends to go to KB Mars homepage. Then in the right-hand column, click on Program Schedule. Then click on Program Page for Rabble-rousing, and past shows will be listed there. Well, I'm in a weird mood, so it's going to be a weird show. It seems like in an eternity that I've been focusing on the elections and the economy. I'm burnt out on both subjects. As far as influencing any of our elected representatives, to quote Bob Dylan, I'd just say good luck. Unless and until we achieve taking bribery and influence peddling out of politics, we the people don't seem to have the clout of the corporations. And I don't see any major reforms on the horizon. The economy, band-aids on top of band-aids. Okay, here we go. First item. Anyone doubt that we're in a recession? Recently released statistics say that 1 out of every 10 Americans is on food stamps. Next item. The International Olympic Committee knows the economy is tough. They're worried about money, as evidenced by this article from the San Francisco Chronicle sports section. Dateline Geneva. The IOC has rejected a bid by Europe's public broadcasters to buy the rights to show the 2014 and 2016 Olympics. The move signals a split between the International Olympic Committee and the European Broadcasting Union, whose members have shown the games on free television since 1956. For those of you mathematically challenged, that's a 53-year-old tradition. Back to the article. The IOC now wants to raise more money from separate deals for individual countries. It has sold Italian and Turkish rights to those games to pay TV stations owned by Rupert Murdoch. So the organizers of the most famous sporting event on the planet, the one that for decades has extolled the virtues of sport over commerce, has finally admitted the sordid truth. The public be damned. When it's a question of sports versus money, money wins. Next item. Regarding the issue of revoking the tax-exempt status of churches who gave financial support to the passage of Proposition 8, experts and activists on the issues say Proposition 8 opponents should look elsewhere for reasons to criticize the measure's supporters. Quote, they almost certainly have not violated their tax exemption. This was said by Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, the leading advocacy organization on the issue. While the tax code has a zero tolerance for endorsements of candidates, the tax code gives wide latitude for churches to engage in discussions of policy matters and moral questions, including when posed as initiatives. There's a caller. Please be patient. Generally speaking, churches, schools, and nonprofits that are 501c3 organizations are prohibited from spending more than 20% of their budgets on political activities. The 20% threshold means that the Catholic or Mormon churches, whose organizations span the globe, would have had to have spent hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, to violate their tax-exempt status. Despite common perception, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints gave relatively small amounts of money to Prop 8. The church's sole filing by November 4th was for $2,000-some-odd, according to the California Secretary of State's office. It was individual Mormons who contributed up to $20 million towards the Yes on 8 campaign, possibly totaling up to half of the campaign's contributions. Similarly, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the leading Catholic body in the nation, gave $200,000, while the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic fraternal group, gave $1.5 million to the effort. So I go back to my original contention. Let the fearful and intolerant bigots have their magic word and work towards what should be the most real issue, and that is full and equal civil rights for all committed couples who enter into civil union. I'm going to interrupt my commentary to take this call. Are you still there? Yeah. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller? Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Yeah, I have my own press release. I'm thankful I didn't lose the vote because of my personal opinion, no matter how muddled. Have you noticed whoever's in power gets criticized, even God?
Is this brief or lengthy?
However you define that, it sounds like a balancing mechanism. What do you think?
Are you referring to Prop 8?
No, I'm referring to our system, our political system worldwide.
Our worldwide political system?
Yep.
And I'm not sure of the point you're making.
Well, I just think that everyone has their opinion.
Okay.
And no matter how muddled it may come out.
Right.
And listening to it is important. And learning the person on the other side, learning what is muddled, they need to get better.
Okay.
And, you know, I love your program. And it's just, I just noticed that, you know, whoever's in power, they get criticized and probably should be criticized because, but after saying that, it seems like a balancing mechanism within the human spirit.
Okay.
It's a good thing.
Okay. Thanks for your opinion.
All right.
Bye-bye. All right. Since we're on to opinions, you got to listen to mine. I'll continue with my commentary. Interesting events in international news. Thailand is in the process of managing to once again have a bloodless revolution as the people blockaded the international airports and the military stood aside as the country ground to a halt. We'll see if the government capitulates and resigns. Could that be a method we could use here in the U.S.? All citizens go out to their local airports and stand on the runways until the government responds to our wishes? Nothing else seems to work. Related item. I went to a concert last weekend of musicians from Zimbabwe. After a most excellent concert, I got to talking with the lead singer and drummer and asked him about life in his homeland, and specifically, how it was that their dictator, Robert Mugabe, who had just lost his bid for re-election, managed to ignore the election results and stay in power. His reply fascinated me. He said that unlike other African nations, the people of Zimbabwe did not believe in fighting and bloody revolutions. He said they'd tried that some years back with the predictable tragic results, and unlike other nations, had learned from their experience that they didn't want to endure that again. The military keeps Mugabe in power, and the people are too wise to fight against the military, so they endure a dictatorship. Postscript to this vignette. Monday's news was that Mugabe may have finally overstepped even his bounds. Reports from Zimbabwe are that some military units went to banks to get their wages and were denied payment. Not being as peace-oriented as their fellow citizens, they then rioted. Note to Mugabe, not a wise move. These are the goons that keep you in power. And who are these goons in the military? For this answer, we turned to a broadcast Monday night on KVMR a documentary of the 1968 student riots in Mexico City just prior to their Olympic Games. According to the documentary, the protesting students soon discovered that the soldiers, who ended up killing many of the students, were the same age as the students. The soldiers were simply poor, uneducated peasants from the countryside, who joined the military not from any political convictions, nor to serve their nation in any philosophic way, but simply to land a good job in a rotten economy. You had the classic case of the upper-class elite pitting poor against poor. The people battle one another while the elite stay in power, sitting on the sidelines, laughing into their cocktails. And if we look at the USA today, is it any different? Look at your own communities. Is it the children of the wealthy that join the military? Are they fighting and dying in the Middle East? Or is it largely the children of the poor? I used to be strongly opposed to a military draft, but upon reflection, I now believe that the children of the elite should have the same rights, privileges, and responsibilities as other Americans. If fighting for your country is a privilege, then we should mandate that privilege to include the children of the rich and powerful. If we are to have endless series of wars in order to control other people's resources, the children of the wealthy and privileged should fight in those wars. If one were to really look at who benefits from these wars, one could make the point that the only combat troops should be the children of the wealthy, and the poor should simply support them behind the lines if they should be there at all. That's my solution. Give guns to the children of Dick Cheney, George W., and all defense industry CEOs, and let them go steal their own oil. Next item. It's often been said that we often take for granted the talent amongst us and fail to recognize just how special some of our friends and neighbors really are. A prime example is Mark Stannard, who has been strong-armed into resuming his weekly commentary on KVMR, Local Views of the News. Anyone who doesn't plan their listening pleasure around hearing Local Views is really missing something special. Compare his commentaries with some of the nationally syndicated stuff, such as Matt Rothschild and his pompous progressive point of view, and you might see what I mean. Stannard's tagline last week was classic and priceless, referring to the local argument that one reason for reopening the Idaho-Maryland gold mine is that gold mining in Nevada County is inherently good because it's an essential part of our history and our culture, i.e. an old tradition. Mark made the succinct point that shooting Indians was once a local tradition, too, but eventually we recognized that the drawbacks outweighed the advantages. Thanks, Mark. Next item. Listeners from out of our immediate area might not relate to this item, but here in the Nevada City area, we have a case of delicious irony. A local auto dealer bought up a prime piece of land just alongside our freeway that cuts through our town, brought in the earth movers, and created a gigantic car lot, filling it with an unbelievable number of new cars and trucks, parked cheek to jowl like military troops on parade. If that eyesore wasn't bad enough, the owner then lit up his gaudy display so it turned night into daylight as you drove on the freeway looking down on his enterprise. The lights were so bright at night that local citizens complained and took him to court. He basically told his fellow citizens to piss off. Free enterprise capitalism, the American right to make money, all the usual reasons to ignore the wishes of your neighbors. Well, I soon trained my eyes to look the other way as I drove by this commercial monstrosity, and so I might be hallucinating. But if my eyes don't deceive me, that gigantic car lot is now devoid of cars, and the lights are off at night. It seems that the American economic meltdown has resulted in a few benefits. Forgive my poor pun, but if this isn't a classic example of karma, I don't know what is. In that light, I'd be curious if any listeners are aware of other changes in our world that the financial meltdown had caused that just might be seen in a positive light. You could call in with brief thoughts on the positive results of our present recession come depression. 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. Meanwhile, I will continue. This article I found interesting. It's out of Nexus Magazine out of Australia. And, okay, here we go. Retired Apollo 14 astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, went public on Kerrang Radio on the West Midlands, United Kingdom, in July of this year with his confirmation that UFOs and aliens do exist, that they visit our planet, and then governments have been covering up the truth for at least the last 60 years. Interviewed by Mark Majerusan, host of the Night Before team, Dr. Mitchell assured with his comment, "The amount of misinformation, covert, and actual attempts to cover up seems to be decreasing. I think we're headed for real disclosure by some serious organizations moving in that direction." Then there's an even more interesting article. A former NASA spacecraft officer admits ETs are real. The guy's name is Clark C. McClellan. "In support of my friend, courageous U.S. NASA astronaut Edgar Mitchell, I, Clark McClellan, former spacecraft officer, space shuttle fleet, personally observed an 8 to 9 foot tall ET on my 27-inch video monitor while on duty in the Kennedy Space Center. Launch Control Center. The ET was standing upright in the space shuttle payload bay having a discussion with two tethered U.S. NASA astronauts. I also observed on my monitors the spacecraft of the ET as it was in a stabilized, safe orbit to the rear of the space shuttle main engine pods. I observed this incident for about 1 minute and 7 seconds, plenty of time to memorize all that I was observing. It was an ET and alien starship. To all who have faith in me, I present you with this artist's concept of what I saw many years ago at the Kennedy Space Center. It was a tall creature, about 8 to 9 feet tall. It had a humanoid body shaped with two arms, two hands, two legs, two feet, a slim torso, and a normal-sized head for its size. The color of its skin I could not determine. It appeared to have what appeared to be eyes, but it was not detailed enough for any other comments. How did it communicate? I have no idea. It did move its arms a lot, almost like giving instructions. I heard no voice communications. The helmet was not large, as the helmets of our two NASA astronauts, and had a viewport to look forward. It had a small, perhaps a communication device, attached only to the right side of the helmet. I saw no oxygen tanks. It had a wide belt-like wrapping around it. It did not appear to be tethered, as the two astronauts were, to the sides of the shuttle structure. I observed nothing that appeared to be a weapon. The time duration of this amazing scene was 1 minute and 7 seconds. I timed it on my astronaut chronograph watch. A friend of mine later contacted me and said this person had also observed an 8 to 9 foot tall ET inside the space shuttle crew compartment. Yes, inside our shuttle. Both missions were Department of Defense, Pentagon, top secret encounters. With my verifiable background, there is no federal government agency that can say I'm crazy. I am a space program pioneer. I assisted in launching the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Apollo Soyuz, Skylab space shuttle and deep space missions, and the International Space Station. I have received character substantiation from Walter Cronkite, Major Donald Kehoe, who was the former NICAP director, Richard Hall, former assistant director of NICAP, astronomer Dr. J. Allen Hynek, etc. I served as assistant state of Florida and MUFON unit director at Kennedy Space Center and the director of NICAP. I have received honorable mention from U.S. senators, congressmen, military officers, and scientists. You can see my website, www.stargate-chronicles.com for more disclosures. In fact, this absolutely verifies what my friend, astronaut Edgar Mitchell of Apollo 14, has recently and courageously released. I've launched or witnessed 650 missions so far in my life. I'm an expert in visually recognizing any craft created and flown by the human race, whether secret or otherwise. I know ET and alien craft when I see them. I was the director of the NICAP Unit 3, actual X-Files at Cape Canaveral and the Kennedy Space Center from 1958 to 92. Yes, the actual X-Files. Aliens are here. They walk amongst us. They may be implanted into our various Earth governments. What I know, they would not allow me to publish. I've written at least 3 books to release the truth to all the human race. I was on the leading edge of the subject, and I met with many NASA and other astronauts throughout the years that I was involved in military and NASA space programs, i.e. 1958 to 92. I've heard many experiences of ETs having been seen on the moon, etc., by NASA astronomers, and I relate those and more in my book. NASA is not a civilian space agency. the Pentagon owns NASA. Some of the Department of Defense missions I participated in were top secret. Those missions carried TS top secret satellites and other space mission hardware into orbit, where several crews met with ETs. I'm ready to tell my story, but for compensation. Please visit my background page to see documents, awards, certificates, photos, proof of my honorable past in the space industry, the United States Space Program, and with NASA, as well as showing some of the recognition I've received from NASA astronauts. That's Clark C. McClellan, former Space Shuttle Fleet Science Officer, Kennedy Space Station, Florida. So, we got other more pressing problems, but it sounds like the UFO situation still exists. The time is 12:34. The place is Nevada City, California. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chambalane. And I'll ramble on for another 25-odd minutes. This next article is by Paul Joseph Watson, writing in PrisonPlanet.com. Ex-Italian president provoke riots, then beat the shit out of the protesters. Former Italian president Francesco Cossiga has offered a solution to the Italian government in dealing with widespread demonstrations by students and teachers over a cut in state funding of education. Use agent provocateurs to start riots and then have the police, quote, beat the shit out of the protesters, close quote. Cossiga, former Italian president, prime minister, minister of the interior, and one of the founders of the Operation Gladio covert intelligence unit, encouraged Silvio Berlusconi and current Minister of the Interior, Robert Maroni, to do what I did when I was Minister of the Interior, namely infiltrate what so far have been relatively peaceful demonstrations, radicalize them, start riots, then engender public support for a heavy-handed police response. Cossiga's full statement translated reads as follows. Maroni should do what I did when I was Minister of the Interior. University students, let them do what they want. Withdraw the police from streets and universities. Infiltrate the movement with provoking agents ready for anything. And in Italian, the term is agenti provocatori. And let them devastate shops, put fires to the cars, and put cities to the sword for 10 days. Then, strengthened by people's support, the sound of the sirens from ambulances will have to overwhelm that from the police in Cabinieri. Law enforcement officers should pitilessly beat the shit out of the protesters and send them all to the hospital. They should not arrest them, since the courts would free them immediately, but they should beat them savagely, and they should beat savagely as well those teachers that incite them. Not the old professors, just the young school teachers. Close quote. Cossiga is essentially describing the problem-reaction-solution dialectic that he exploited when he was in government. Under the banner of Operation Gladio, which was unveiled after parliamentary investigations in Italy, Switzerland, and Belgium, NATO-sponsored secret armies committed acts of violence and terrorism and blamed the attacks on left-wing political movements, allowing far-right governments to seize power in numerous European countries. You had to attack civilians, the people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people, far removed from any political game, right-wing terrorist and Gladio agent Vincenzo Vinciguerra explained the so-called strategy of tension in sworn testimony. The reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. This is the political logic that lies behind all the massacres and the bombings which remain unpunished, because the state cannot convict itself or declare itself responsible for what happened. Close quote. Gladio orchestrated false flag terror attacks, such as the Bologna train bombing in 1980, which killed 85 people, were revealed during the Italian parliamentary investigation as having been overseen by elements of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. At the very least, U.S. intelligence sat on prior knowledge of bombings and allowed them to go ahead. Cossiga's call to infiltrate protest groups and provocateur violence, given the police public backing to beat the shit out of all of them, is a false flag tactic that has been employed numerous times during major protest events around the world. Indeed, the scenario Kosiga is describing is exactly what happened at the violent 2001 Genoa G8 summit, during which Italian police planted bombs in headquarters being used by protest groups as an excuse to conduct raids and beat the crap out of peaceful demonstrators. A similar tactic was also attempted during last year's SPP summit protest in Quebec, Canada. Canadian police were caught dressed up as rock-wielding anarchists intent on causing riots. Peaceful protesters identified the agent provocateurs, and the police later had to admit the fact, despite going to the lengths of publicly staging the arrests of their own officers. Last year, Kosiga drew on his first-hand personal experience in conducting false flag terror operations to declare that 9/11 was an inside job and that this fact was common knowledge amongst global intelligence agencies. Just to add to my comment to that, those of you familiar with the World Trade Organization riots in Seattle and later riots and demonstrations and that turned violent around the United States will recognize this tactic. Okay, I want to stay out of the, as I said, I wanted to stay out of the economy as much as possible, but I think this article is worth reading and listening to. It's time to move on to Plan B by Mike Whitney, writing at SmirkingChimp.com. The winter of 2008-2009 will prove to be the winter of global economic discontent that marks the rejection of the flawed ideology that unregulated global financial markets promote financial innovation, market efficiency, unhampered growth, and endless prosperity while mitigating risk by spreading it system-wide. Economists Paul Davidson and Henry C.K. Liu, in Open Letter to the World Leaders, attending the November 15th White House Summit on Financial Markets and the World Economy. The global economy has been sucked into a black hole, and most Americans have no idea why. The whole problem can be narrowed down to two words, structured finance. Structured finance is a term that designates a sector of finance where risk is transferred via complex legal and corporate entities. It's not as confusing as it sounds. Take a mortgage-backed security, MBS, for example. The mortgage is issued by a bank, the loan originator, which then sells the mortgage to a brokerage where it is chopped up into tranches, pieces of the loan, and sold in a pool of mortgages to investors that are looking for a rate that is greater than treasuries or similar investments. The process of transforming debt, the mortgage, into a security is called securitization. At one time, the MBS was a reasonably safe investment because the housing market was stable and there were relatively few foreclosures. Thus, the chance of losing one's investment was quite small. In the early years of the Bush administration, Wall Street took advantage of the gigantic flow of capital coming into the country, $700 billion per year via the current amount deficit, by creating more and more MBSs and selling them to foreign banks, hedge funds, and insurance companies. It was a real gold rush. Because the banks were merely the mortgage originators, they didn't believe their own money was at risk, so they gradually lowered lending standards and issued millions of loans to unqualified applicants who had no job, no collateral, and a bad credit history. Securitization was such a hit that by 2005, nearly 80% of all mortgages were securitized, and the traditional criteria for getting a mortgage was abandoned altogether. Subprimes, Alt A's and ARMs flourished, while the 30-year fixed went the way of the dodo. Lenders were no longer constrained by credit worthiness. Anyone with a pulse and a pen could get approved. The mortgages were then shipped off to Wall Street, where they were sold to credulous investors. The disaggregation of risk spreading, the risk to many investors via securitization, was as much of a factor in the creation of the largest equity bubble in history as the bankers' lax lending standards or Greenspan's low interest rates. By spreading risk throughout the system, securitization kept interest rates artificially low because the real risks are not properly priced. The low interest rates in turn simulate speculation, which results in equity bubbles. Eventually, credit expansion leads to crisis when borrowers can no longer make the interest payment on their loans and defaults spiral out of control. This forces massive deleveraging and the fire sale of assets in illiquid markets. And as assets lose value, prices fall, and the economy enters a deflationary cycle. There are many types of structured instruments, including asset-backed securities, ABS, mortgage-backed securities, MBS, collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, and collateralized loan obligations, CLOs, all of which provide a revenue stream from loans that were chopped into tranches and turned into securities. There are many problems with these complex securities, the biggest of which is that there's no way to unravel the individual pools of loans to isolate the bad paper. That's why subprime mortgages had such a destructive effect on the secondary market. Because even though subprimes only defaulted at a rate of roughly 5%, MBS sales slumped nearly 90%. Why? Former Secretary of Treasury Paul O'Neill explained it like this. It's like you have 8 bottles of water and just one of them has arsenic in it. It becomes impossible to sell any of the other bottles because no one knows which one contains the poison. Exactly right. So why weren't these structured debt instruments stress-tested before the markets were reworked and the financial system became so dependent on them? Greed. Because the real purpose of these exotic investments is not to provide true value to the buyer, but to maximize profits for the seller by increasing leverage. That is the real purpose of MBSBs, CDOs, and all the other bizarre-sounding derivatives, higher profits with less capital. It's a scam. Here's how it works. A mortgage applicant buys a house for $400,000 and puts 10% down. His mortgage is sold to Wall Street, chopped into pieces and stitched together in a pool of similar loans. Now the brokerage can use the debt as if it were an asset, borrowing at ratios of 20 or 30 to 1 to fatten the bottom line. When Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were taken into conservatorship by the government, they were leveraged at an eye-popping 100 to 1. This shows that nearly an infinite amount of debt can be precariously balanced atop a paltry amount of capital. This explains why the $4 trillion aggregate value of the 5 big investment banks and the $1.7 trillion value of the hedge funds is now vanishing more quickly than it was created. Once the mighty gears of structured finance shift into reverse, deleveraging begins with a vengeance, pulling trillions into a credit vacuum. It all started when 2 Bear Stearns hedge funds defaulted in July of 06, and there were no offers for their MBS and other structured investments. Panic quickly spread to every corner of Wall Street as the alchemists of modern finance began to see that their worst nightmare might be realized, that trillions of dollars of Frankenstein investments could be worth nothing at all. Since the Bear Stearns funds fiasco, there have been huge explosions in the financial markets. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Wachovia, Washington Mutual, India Bank, AIG, Lehman Brothers, and other industry giants have either gone under or been forced into shotgun weddings by the FDIC. The stock market has plunged over 40% and suffered wild gyrations not seen since the 30s. The entire Wall Street landscape has changed completely. Investment banking is no longer a viable business model. The big five have either vanished or transformed themselves into holding companies to escape short sellers. The hedge funds have been deleveraging with a ferocity that has sent stocks and commodities crashing. In one day last week, the stock market plunged 300 points in the morning, only to bounce back 550 points a few hours later, a whopping 850-point spread in one trading day. No one but a madman would dabble in this market. Cautious investors have pulled up stakes and moved to the safety of treasuries. Meanwhile, the financial tsunami is roaring through the real economy, where consumer confidence has plummeted, unemployment is soaring, and retail sales have fallen to historic lows. The downfall from the financial markets has flattened Wall Street and set a stage for a humongous $500 billion stimulus package to be delivered in the first few months of the Obama administration. The meltdown appears to be playing out much like Henry Paulson anticipated. According to Bloomberg News, quote, shortly after leaving Wall Street as Goldman Sachs CEO, Henry Paulson was at Camp David warning the president and his staff of over-the-counter derivatives as an example of financial innovation that could, under certain circumstances, blow up in Wall Street's face and affect the whole economy. Close quote. So far, the Federal Reserve has provided nearly $2 trillion through its lending facilities just to keep the financial system upright. The Treasury is currently distributing $700 billion to key banks and other financial institutions that are perceived as too big to fail. In truth, the too-big-to-fail mantra is just public relations hoax to conceal the web of counterparty deals that make it impossible for one institution to fail without dominoing through the rest of the system and wreaking havoc. That's why AIG is still on life support, with regular injections of taxpayer money, because it had roughly $4 trillion of credit default swaps, structured hedges that are not traded on a regulated exchange, for which AIG does not have sufficient capital reserves. In other words, the taxpayer is now paying the debts of an insurance company that didn't set aside the money to pay its claims. As yet, no SEC indictments for security fraud. In fact, the Fed and Treasury are now providing a backstop for the entire structured financial system, which is frozen solid and shows no signs of thawing anytime soon. This is not a normal recession, which is a downturn in the business cycle and a period of reduced economic activity, usually brought on by a mismatch between supply and demand. That ends in 2 quarters of negative growth. The present situation is much more grave. It is the utter destruction of a system that was developed fairly recently and has proven to be thoroughly dysfunctional. It cannot withstand the effects of tighter credit or adverse market conditions. This is not a cyclical downturn. The structured financial system has collapsed, leaving behind a multi-trillion-dollar capital hole that is bringing the broader economy to its knees. One by one, we've seen the structured instruments fail. Mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations, credit default swaps, commercial paper, auction-rate securities. Now we are seeing investors boycott anything related to structured investments. This is from Mish's Global Economic Trend Analysis. Quote, there were no sales of bonds backed by credit card payments in October, the first time since 1993, when the asset-backed securities market was in its infancy. Yields on top-rated credit card bonds relative to benchmark interest rates reached a record high, more than the London Interbank Offered Rate, which is LIBOR, last week. I don't know what that means, but maybe you guys do. Wall Street has turned off the faucet for securitized investments. That market is toast. The only reason that LIBOR and the other gauges of interbank lending have normalized is because the Fed guaranteed money markets and commercial paper. It has nothing to do with the trust between the banks themselves. There is no trust. Even so, the banks are not capable of making up for the vast amount of credit which was produced by the now defunct investment banks and hedge funds, which are constrained by losses of nearly $3.5 trillion, half of their total value. In the best-case scenario, bank credit will only shrink 10 or 15%, which will put the U.S. on track for a deep 18 months to 2-year recession, rather than another Great Depression. That's in the best scenario. Paulson's attempt to divert $30 billion to non-bank financial institutions to revive loan securitization, when there is no appetite among investors for such a structured junk, is pure folly. More troubling is that neither Paulson nor Bernanke have a plan B, an alternative scheme for rebuilding the financial market on a solid, sustainable foundation, rather than low interest rates and pools of debt. Everything they've done so far suggests that they're focused on one thing alone, inflating another equity bubble. Inflate or die, as the saying goes, and Bernanke intends to achieve this objective using the same tools that brought us to the brink of catastrophe. Here's a clip from a recent speech by Bernanke which shows his determination to prop up the broken system. Quote, the ability of financial intermediaries to sell the mortgages they originate into the broader capital market by means of the securitization process serves two important purposes. First, it provides originators much wider sources of funding than they could obtain through conventional sources, such as retail deposits. Second, it substantially reduces the originator's exposure to interest rate, credit, prepayment, and other risks associated with holding mortgages to maturity, thereby reducing the overall cost of providing mortgage credit. Sorry, Ben, the funding has dried up and the banks have shown no interest in going back to the days of conventional 30-year fixed mortgages. It's a dead letter. The Fed and Treasury needs to stop looking for ways to reinflate the bubble and work to restore confidence in the markets by increasing regulation and reducing the amount of leverage that's allowable to 12 to 1. After all, it's no coincidence that the AIG, Fannie and Freddie, Lehman Brothers, General Motors, General Electric have fallen off a cliff at the very same time. They're all victims of the same low-interest, easy-money finance swindle, which allowed them to roll over huge amounts of short-term debt at artificially low cost. When Bear blew up, lending tightened, demand weakened, and credit was flushed from the system to an unprecedented pace. Borrowing short for long-term investments is not feasible when credit becomes scarce. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead in this. It's just too much. Let's go to his final paragraph. Neoliberal economies in the last three decades have denied the possibility of a replay of the worldwide destructiveness of the Great Depression that followed the collapse of the speculative bubble created by unfettered U.S. financial markets in the Roaring Twenties. They fooled themselves into thinking that false prosperity, built on debt, could be sustainable with monetary indulgence. Now history is repeating itself, this time with a new, more lethal virus that has infested deregulated global finance markets with innovative debt securitizations, structured finance, and maverick banking operations flooded with excess liquidity released by accommodative central banks. A massive structure of phantom wealth was built on the quicksand of debt manipulation. This debt bubble finally imploded in July of 2007 and is now threatening to bring down the entire global financial system to cause an economic meltdown unless enlightened political leadership adopts coordinated corrective measures on a global scale. Rome is burning. It's time to stop tinkering with a failed system and move on to Plan B before it's too late. My comment. Barack Obama, for all his wonderful platitudes, has no Plan B, and judging from his appointment, seems to be totally uninterested in even considering that we need a Plan B. Hang on to your hats, folks. The bumpy ride will continue. Okay, I think we got time with this one. This is one of my favorite guys, Fred Reading, writing, and Fred on everything. President Obama, wedding bombs and other good news, maybe if you aren't smoking something really good. I'm going to slit my wrists. I've been reading the news again. I always want to slit my wrists when I do that. I know, I'll get encouragement from readers. Okay, then I won't slit my wrists, just to spite them. One story says that Americans owe some bizarre sum to the credit card and God knows how much on the McMansion and on the 500-horsepower riding mower with a mini combine backhoe attachment and satellite GPS for mowing that half acre. I think I'm supposed to feel sorry for them. Actually, I think they're a persuasive argument for eugenics. I don't get it. What's wrong with these idiots? Debt is easy to avoid. Herewith, some blinding wisdom. If you can't pay for it, don't buy it. You saw it here first, a percipient contribution to economic theory. Works like a charm, too. Or how about this? Don't buy more house than you can live in. Move over, Keynes, Ricardo, here I come. Another story is about how banks are all unhappy because they've got bad loans. A probing question, if I may. Who made the bad loans? Permit me another soaring insight. If you lend more money to people who can't pay it back, they won't. I know, a difficult concept, not something a Wall Street banker would understand. Thank God America isn't a third world country. In Mexico, the radio station of the local university and other commie fronts grouse about la impunidad. Impunity, meaning that high-ranking criminals never get punished. You know, like the GQ cover psychopaths who brought about the savings and loan scandal, or Mike and Boesky and Levine, or Enron, and now the impoverishment of half the planet. But what can you expect? Mexico is a very corrupt country. What I think we need is a mass hanging. But then no, the culprits will just reshuffle into the administration of President Obama and remain attached, tick-like, to the withering federal dugs. The rats in the rafters may not be savory, but they look out for each other. Okay, I'm running out of time, and it's obvious that he's absolutely right. Obama is putting the same people back in power, and we're going to have the same shenanigans going on. I'm out of time. Thanks very much for listening. Stay tuned for Mel Walsh and Second Wind, and we're going to go out with a selection by Odetta, who was a powerhouse in the civil rights movement, and we miss her.
And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free. No more moaning, no more moaning, no morning over me. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried.